So as Josh just said, we've started this new series just last week that we titled Creed. And we are making our way through the Apostles' Creed, which maybe some of you grew up reciting the Apostles' Creed. But the Apostles' Creed goes through the things that we believe, the doctrines, the truths of the Christian faith, what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And so we're taking these different phrases from the Creed to talk about them this month. And so today I want to look at God. The Creed opens with these words: I believe in God the Father Almighty. And I want to talk about that phrase this morning. I believe in God the Father Almighty. And I love how in the Apostles' Creed it says, I believe in God the Father. And today I want to focus in on this attribute of God, is that he's just not any ordinary father, but he is a good father. He is the very good father, as Josh was just talking about. I think in life, there's two kinds of fathers, right? Two kinds of dads. There's good dads, there's good fathers, and then there's bad dads. I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying it. Years ago, when I was a college pastor in Los Angeles, I had a coworker who was our high school pastor, and I only worked with him like a year, but one day he shows up in the morning, and I say, how'd things go last night? He said, I had the strangest night last night. I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I went out to 7-Eleven to get something to eat. That's what he said. And he said, I'm walking the aisles, and I see this father with like a 8 or 9 year old son, and he said, I don't know what the son said or did, but all of a sudden, the father hauled off and just whacked him in the back of the head. And I said, well, Jeff, what'd you do after that? He said, well, I walked up behind the father and I whacked him in the back of the head. And I said, it doesn't feel so good, does it? That's really what he did. And I said, what'd the man do? He said, he just left. He just left the store. So I don't know if that was the right response. But that's a bad father. If a father is going around hitting his son in the back of the head to teach him a lesson, who needs a father like that? You know, you live neurotic and in fear all the time. When we talk about God and who he is, I think there's often two perceptions of God out there. There's a perception of God that I hope you have in your heart and you leave with today, that we have a good father. A father in heaven who is patient and loving and compassionate. But there are so many perceptions of God that only make God out to be this mean, judgmental, angry deity that's waiting to punish us, hit us upside the back of the head when we make a mistake. The Hebrew people, when Jesus arrived on the scene 2,000 years ago, the Jewish people lived neurotic lives trying to please God, because Judaism had filled with all kinds of legalism. I don't know if you know much about the Talmud. The Talmud is a collection of writings of things that the Jewish people could and could not do. This is extra biblical. It's not from the Bible. It's just rules they made up to live by, trying to please God. They had picked up this Canaanite idea that if you didn't please God, he would punish you. Your crops wouldn't grow, your children would get sick, your marriages would fail. And so the Hebrew people picked up this fear of God and lived in constant fear of God, and I think and missed out that he's a loving God. But I'll just give you a few examples from the Talmud of how the Jewish people were living at the time. For example, in the Talmud, it says that on the Sabbath, on their Sabbath day, you can't look in the mirror, because if you looked in the mirror, you might see a gray hair and be tempted to pull it out. Then you'd be doing the work of a hairstylist, right? So that was banned. On the Sabbath day, you couldn't kill an insect. That would be hunting. I don't know if you eat insects, but it'd be considered hunting. On the Sabbath, you could not take a bath or shower, because if water spilled on the floor, you would be washing the floor. If somebody was sick or was wounded or injured, you could treat them enough to keep them alive. But if you helped them heal, then that was a sin, because you're performing the work of a doctor or a nurse in our case. And so you had all these strange rules and laws, all built out of the fear of God. Yes, now don't miss what I'm saying today. Sin is real, and it is an offense to God, and it distances us from God. But the God of the Bible never meant for us to live in constant fear of him only, but to love him. I think that's at the root of who he is and who Jesus came to tell us about him. And this narrative that our God is an angry, mean God isn't just an ancient Hebrew idea. I'm going to be honest with you. It's a modern church idea as well. And I know this because I grew up in a Christian culture where we heard much more about the judging and the punishment of God, and it's there, than we did of the love of God and that he's our Father who cares about us and is compassionate to us. I grew up in a Christian culture that we knew sermons. There were famous sermons that had been around for like 150 years. One was titled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. There's nothing wrong with a sermon, but it just put a lot of fear in your heart because this preacher in this famous sermon said, you are like a spider dangling from a single thread over a flame. And that was a picture in my mind. Like, if I make one mistake, that thread's gonna sever and I'm in the flames of hell, all right? So as a kid, I was always asking God back in my heart because I thought maybe he had abandoned me. We lived in constant fear that, shoot, if you snuck out of the house and went to a dance, which we weren't allowed to, or went to an R-rated movie like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you're gonna burn in hell. That was a constant fear, at least in my experience that we lived with. And no one, it seemed, preached much or said much about the love of God. But then Jesus comes along 2,000 years ago and says to the Hebrew people and to the Gentiles, you don't have to perform anymore to keep God happy. You pleasing God is not based on what you do or do not do. It's based on where your heart is. And he reminds everyone that we worship a loving, compassionate, a very good God. And when Jesus is here, especially his 3 years of ministry, he comes as a living manifestation of who God is, showing us his goodness and his compassion, healing, reaching out to the marginalized. But Jesus was constantly showing us in his own life the goodness of God. In his very first sermon, and we have it on the screen, Matthew 7, Jesus says this in verse 9. He says, which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone, or if he asked for fish, would give him a snake. If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask? Do you see how Jesus is trying to remind us that we have this good Father? I love Chris Tomlin's song. I have the words on the screen here. Chris Tomlin writes this. We sing it at the Grove once in a while. It's been around a little while, but it goes, I've heard 1,000 stories of what they think you're like, but I've heard the tender whispers of your love in the dead of night. And you tell me that you're pleased and that I'm never alone because you're a good Father. It's who you are, and I am loved by you. It's who I am. And so Tomlin here reminds us that not only do we have a good Father, but we are the ones who are loved by the good Father. Like I said, I think there's two kinds of fathers. There are good fathers, and there are mean fathers. My father, I'm going to be honest with you, was a very, in my opinion, a very, very good father. I can't remember my father ever losing his temper with me and my twin brother. I can't remember him ever shouting at us in anger. It just never happened. He was a very good father. I had a friend, though, named Mike. Mike, I grew up with him all through elementary school. And Mike, in my opinion, had a bad father. Because Mike, not only was he grounded, it seemed like half the time, he'd be grounded sometimes for days or weeks at a time. But he would show up to hang out with us, and he would have welts on the back of his legs, and he would show us this, or on his back where his father had beat him with a belt. And so Mike lived in this constant fear. He lived almost neurotic, thinking that, did I do something wrong today? When I get home, is my dad going to yell at me, punish me, send me to my room, scream at me, hit me with the belt again? I was blessed to have a very good father. He had a very bad father. There's a huge difference. I had four brothers, and I have three older brothers. Now, my older brothers, don't get me wrong, they got in trouble all the time, but they were knuckleheads. They did things like one of them took my grandfather's credit card to rent a helicopter in San Francisco to take a girl on a date, all right? So I had brothers No, I'm not making this up. You know, and one of them took a Corvette on a test drive in Jackson, Mississippi to Vancouver, Canada, all right? So they got in a lot of trouble, all right? But me and my twin brother, not like we were perfect, but we didn't get in trouble, all right? Because, and as I thought about it, it wasn't because I feared my father. Yeah, he was a strong man. Don't get me wrong about that. He was a Navy lieutenant, all right? So he's a very strong man, but I wasn't a good son because I feared my father. I think I was an obedient son because I loved my father. My fear wasn't if I did something wrong that my father would punish me in some kind of terrible way. My greatest fear was if I did something wrong that I would disappoint my father. And what is a better motivation in life? To please someone because you're afraid of them, or to please someone because you love them? And that's the kind of relationship that Jesus wants us to have with our Father in heaven. And I think this is why he keeps trying to show us that we have a very good Father. I have this key idea on the screen if you want to look at it with me. Today, I want to invite you to reclaim this radical, revolutionary message of Jesus Christ, that God, your Father, is ultimately good, purely good. And sometimes, even people who go to church all the time, we miss that. Today, I want to give you a doctrine of God. It's theology proper. I want to give you an understanding of who God is through the lens of one story that Jesus tells us. So if you have your Bibles, grab it. This will be our text for today, or follow on the screen as I read. And I'm going to read a lot of it, so listen along. I'm reading from the Passion Translation today. Then Jesus said, "Once there was a father with two sons, and the younger son came to his father and said, 'Father, don't you think it's time to give me my share of your estate?' So the father went ahead and distributed between the two sons their inheritance. And shortly afterwards, the younger son packed up all his belongings and traveled off to see the world. And he journeyed to a far-off land where he soon wasted all he was given in a binge of extravagant and reckless living. With everything spent and nothing left, he grew hungry because there was severe famine in the land. So the son finally realized what he was doing and thought, 'There are many workers at my father's house who have all the food they want and plenty to spare. They lack nothing. Why am I dying of hunger, feeding these pigs and eating their slop? I want to go back home to my father's house. And I'll say to him, Father, I was wrong. I've sinned against you. Move down.' So the son set out for home. From a long distance away, the father saw him coming dressed as a beggar, and great compassion swelled up in his heart for his son who was returning home. And the father raced out to meet him, swept him up in his arms, hugged him dearly, and kissed him over and over with tender love. Then the son said, 'Father, I was wrong. I've sinned against you. I could never deserve to be called your son.' Then the father interrupted and said, 'Son, you're home now.' Turning to his servants, the father said, 'Quick, bring me the best robe, the best of my robe, and place it on his shoulders. Bring me a ring.'" Verse 25, "Now the older son was out working in the field when his brother returned. And as he approached the house, he heard the music of celebration and dancing. And he called over one of the servants and asked, 'What's going on?' And the servant replied, 'It's your younger brother. He's returned home. And your father is throwing a party to celebrate his homecoming.' The older brother became angry and refused to go and celebrate. So the father came out and pleaded with him, 'Come and enjoy the feast with us.' And the son said, 'Father, I've never once disobeyed you, but you've never thrown a party for me.' And the father said, 'It's only right to rejoice and celebrate like this because your brother was dead and gone, but now he is alive and he's back with us again. He was lost and now he's found.'" It's a great story. You know it well. I want to spend our time this morning talking about this story, because in the story we read, it opens with this line: "There was a father with two sons." And usually, almost always, we make this story about the youngest son, right? The runaway, the prodigal son, the son who was reckless. Maybe, though, we miss that the story is most about the father. Is it possible the story is Jesus wants us most to see how good the father is? So in this story, we have two main characters. We have the youngest son. The youngest son is, of course, the baby of the family. He's a little bit spoiled. He's slightly irresponsible. He's the life of the party. You know, that's the youngest son. He always gets his way. That's the youngest son. And then you have the older brother, the eldest brother. And the older brother, he's the firstborn, so he's in charge of everything, isn't he? Some of you in the room are firstborns. We know what you're like. He's a rule follower. He cleans his bedroom. He makes his bed. He's a little bossy. He makes his younger brother feel small just by the way he criticizes him. He's judgmental, and he's a little proud. Now, if you notice here, there's no mention of a middle child. Psychologists say that the middle child is the healthiest and most well-adjusted. So there's no mention of this child. We just have the youngest son and the eldest son. And we read that the youngest boy asked for his inheritance. And this is a big deal because the father has to liquidate his assets to give this boy what he wants. So the whole village knows that the father now is selling his sheep and selling land in order to give this boy his inheritance early. Everyone's aware of it. And then we read that this boy takes his trust fund and he leaves for a place. He leaves for a city where there is temptation and partying 24/7. There's pleasure and drinking and temptation of all kinds and gluttony. We have a city just like that in our country, right? You know the city I'm thinking about? You know it well. Scottsdale. You've been there. I know you have. But then, Scottsdale. Some of you live in Scottsdale. We love you. Awesome. All right. But then we read that this young son, he loses it all. He's broke. He's hungry. He gets a job feeding pigs. And he starts dreaming of going home. But we can tell he's hesitant to go home. One of my favorite writers, John Orberg, explains why. He says that the Jewish people have a ceremony that's reserved for if a son takes their inheritance or takes the family's wealth and he goes and he lives among the Gentiles, and if he loses the family's reputation and all that they own, and he tries to come back to the village, he says there's a ceremony that the Hebrew people would perform. They would go out to the front gate. It's called Kizezar. And they would meet this returning son at the front gate, and they would take a clay pot. It's a very visual society. They would literally at the front gate break a clay pot in front of this son who had just squandered his family's money and wealth. And they would take those broken pieces and say, "You have broken our tribe like this. You have broken our village. You have broken your family. You have broken the hearts of your mother and your father. So Kizezar." Kizezar means cut off. You are cut off now. You are no longer called a son or a daughter here. You are no longer a part of this tribe or this village. And they would ban them from the community. So this son knows if I go home, then there's a good chance the village leaders are going to meet me at the front gate and break a clay pot and say Kizezar and try to run me out of here. But the son is not expecting what he finds when he gets there, is he? The son does not know that there is a good, good father waiting for him, the way Jesus tells the story. And in this story, we read that the father, who clearly represents God, he's standing outside his house. We don't know for how many days, how many weeks, how many months, but he's standing there every day, scanning the horizon, looking for his son. Is there a chance my son will come home today? And then what happens? He sees him. He sees just way out in the distance. Maybe it's just a silhouette at first. And he thinks, could that be my boy coming home? Is it possible? Can it be? And then he sees him as he comes a little closer. He sees his walk, maybe his gait, and he knows his son's gait. So the father starts to walk that way. Maybe this is him coming home. Could it be the day? And then as he gets closer, he sees it just might be. So the father breaks into a jog. And then he sees for sure, that's my son. And Luke says, it's a dead sprint. Luke uses athlete's language here for racers, sprinters. And he says, the father runs to the father, or runs to the son. Some say that in Jesus' story, the father runs to his son because he wants to beat the rest of the village to him. He wants to get to the son before anyone else can get to him and say, Kizezar, you're not welcome here. The father was running because he wanted to be the first one there. And here's the thing about Hebrew culture. Strong Hebrew men, fathers, don't run. They don't show their ankles, literally. They don't pull their robe up and run. Dignified Hebrew men, respectable Hebrew men don't run. But Jesus wants us to see that this father, our God, is a God who runs to us when we start to come home. You take that one single step toward him and he starts running to you to take you back. You see how Jesus is saying, you have a father who's filled with compassion, who's filled with forgiveness. There's nothing that the son has to do to earn this love of the father, is there? Here's the one thing Jesus doesn't say. The father doesn't say, I hope you've learned your lesson. The son starts to give his speech, and the father cuts him off, and he says, no, you're home now. I don't have to hear that. You're forgiven. You're home now. Now, there's the older brother, and I think there's a lot of Christians who are like the older brother. They end up being judgmental and critical and arrogant, thinking that you have to earn the love of the father. And Jesus wants us to see, no, you don't have to earn the love of the father. One of my favorite books for years and years has been Philip Yancey's What's So Amazing About Grace. And in What's So Amazing About Grace, he has a chapter titled The Lovesick Father. And in it, Philip Yancey retells a modern day version of Jesus's parable. So I want to end our time together by simply reading this to you, all right? And by the way, you need a copy of this book if you haven't read it yet. What's So Amazing About Grace? A young girl grows up on a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents, a bit old-fashioned, tend to overreact to her nose ring, the music she listens to, the length of her skirts. They ground her a few times, and she sees inside. I hate you, she screams when her father knocks on her door after they've had an argument. And that night, she acts on a plan that she's been rehearsing in her mind countless times. She runs away from home, and she finds a way all the way to Los Angeles. Her second day in Los Angeles, she meets a man who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride. He buys her lunch. He arranges for a place for her to stay. And he gives her pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. She was right all along, she decides. Her parents were trying to keep her from all the fun. The man with the big car calls himself boss. He teaches her a few things that men like. She starts to earn some money. After a year, the first signs of illness appear, and it amazes her how fast the boss becomes mean. Before she knows it, he kicks her out, and she's on the street without a penny to her name. When winter blows in, she finds herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big department stores. One night as she lays awake, all of a sudden, everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman of the world. She feels like a little girl lost in a cold and frightening city. She begins to whimper. Her pockets are empty. She's hungry. She needs a fix. She pulls her legs up tight underneath her and shivers under the newspapers that she's piled on top of her coat. Something jolts a memory. Just a single image fills her mind of May in Traverse City when a million cherry trees blossom at once and her golden retriever runs through the rows and rows of blossoming trees. God, why did I leave? She says to herself, and the pain stabs her heart. She sobs now, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she just wants to go home. So she pulls out her cell phone and three straight phone calls, no one answers. She hangs up the first two times, but the third time she leaves a voicemail. She says, Mom, Dad, it's me. I was wondering, can I come home? I'm going to get on a bus. It's all I can afford. And I'll be there tomorrow night at about midnight. If you're not at the bus station in Traverse City, I guess I'll just stay on the bus until it reaches New York. She keeps rehearsing the speech she's been preparing it for her father the entire ride. "Dad, I'm sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault, it's mine. Dad, can you forgive me?" She says the words over and over. Now her throat is tightening. When the bus finally pulls into the station, she checks herself in a compact mirror, smooths her hair, licks the lipstick off her teeth. She walks into the terminal not knowing what to expect. Not one of the thousand scenes that she has played over and over in her mind prepare her for what she will see. There, in this cold, stark bus station in Traverse City, Michigan, stands a group of 40 brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins and grandmothers and a great-grandmother to boot. And they're all wearing goofy party hats and blowing noisemakers. And taped across the entire wall of the bus terminal is a banner that reads, "Welcome home." Out of the crowd breaks her father. She starts through the tears to give her memorized speech. "Dad, I'm sorry. I know." But he interrupts her. He says, "Hush, sweetheart." He says, "We've got no time for that. No time for apologies. We'll be late for your party. Dinner's waiting at home." And his story ends there. Do you see what Philip Yancey is trying to remind us of? That we have a God who loves you more than you could ever imagine. We have a God who is waiting with open arms to take you back. And maybe today you've been running away from him. Maybe today you've made some really big mistakes. You've made a mess at work. You made a mess maybe of your friendships. Maybe you've made a mess of your family or your marriage. And I want to say you have a Father in heaven, a good Father who says, "Come home now. It's okay." That's what he has for you. Can we pray together? Would you bow your heads? Because maybe you need this love and this grace of the Father more than ever before. And so simply pray these words. "God, I come to you. I know I've sinned. I know I was wrong. God, forgive me. God, thank you that you are a Father who waits for me with open arms. Thank you for your love that I know that can wash away all that I've done. Remind me today that I am your son, I am your daughter, not just now, but forever and ever and ever." Amen. Amen.